Welcome back. It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Once again, we are here to fill in the ranks of the rhetoric guardians of the galaxy. So come on in and help us clean up public discourse, because it's gotten dirty. It's gotten filthy out there. There's pollution in the discourse streams. I am Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. Here on the podcast, I try to do three things. I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics. Always interesting. I convert conservatives because the right worries me, and I think they need to be a little more aware of how they talk and how democracy is supposed to work. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians. This podcast has more rhetoricians than any other podcast in the world that you're going to hear today. And today is another episode of rhetorician interviews. And my guest today is an academic rhetorician. He teaches at Oklahoma State. He's interested in all the interesting stuff, disinformation, the dark web, deep recesses of the extremist right, comic books, and punk rock. Dr. Brian Lee Jones, Jonesy.
Oh, thank you for that introduction. Mentioning comic books and punk rock just makes me feel so good.
Yeah, come on. How can you not be cool to talk to if you like comic books and punk rock?
Right.
And trying disinformation.
Yeah, it's all connected. It's just all right there. I feel like comic books are really one of the most clear and precise ways to communicate. I mean, it's just a really effective medium. And I would love to see that used a lot more in academics or politics or whatever. I mean, going back to the old days, the old political cartoons, that's a big part of what was making that.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like when you actually look at the history of political cartooning and comic books, so all the way up into graphic novels and all that kind of stuff, it is a fascinating trove of rhetoric for sure. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to backtrack just a little bit. We recorded this earlier one time and tech failed on both sides. So the levels were bad. I'm not a producer, a technical producer, so I could not fix things. So we're back to recreate some of that. But really, the first time I usually talk to somebody, I would do a lot of bio stuff anyway. And then I always want to come back and dive in. So I kind of know your bio now.
Yeah, there we go.
So we can dive. Yeah, but let's start with this. Like, you and I both started up into this, into rhetoric and academics, basically from a working class background.
Yeah.
Which isn't a normal academic pathway that people take.
No.
So talk about your entry into that a little bit.
Well, you know, I was one of those students that probably should not have went to college right away. I mean, honestly, if I'm being total, you know, cards on the table with everything, I probably would have benefited from taking a year or two off between high school and college, because I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was just there because I thought that's what I was supposed to do.
Sure. It's a narrative. And, it's one of the,
Right. Right. And I just felt everybody around me was phony. And I guess because I just didn't grow out of that phase until later. But I just didn't like it. I didn't feel like I was doing what I was supposed to do or what I needed to do. I tried to go with theater first because I thought I wanted to be a playwright. And it just didn't work out for various reasons. And I ended up dropping out. And the best job I could get was at a factory. And that made me go, you know, I need to get a degree because I don't like this job and it's the best I could get. So I went back to get a degree and I didn't have enough money to quit right away.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, being in the working class, like having to make a living in the working class will definitely make you want to go up to the non-working class.
Right, it does.
The non-physical class.
It's like, you know, I don't like the manual labor part of it. I didn't like that there was so many hours devoted to that, but not enough return. So like I had no life outside of going to that factory every day. And then on the weekends, I was spent most of that time sleeping and recovering because I was doing such big manual labor. And there was something at the time, I didn't know what to call it, but at the time there was something in the rhetoric of the way the company was talking about sustaining itself and how happy they were to have us as workers and how bad it would be if we started a union. Something was really fishy about that. And then, of course, I ended up getting enough money to quit. And I devised this harebrained scheme that if I went back into academia and I just stayed long enough, they would maybe let me teach if I got a degree. And that happened. And then as I stuck around, I was like, well, I did that. So why don't I just go ahead and get the PhD too and see what doors that opens? That's kind of how I ended up being here. But the factory ended up closing about a year after I quit.
Well, you know,
with record profits, which is kind of the
right, of course, I think. The truth of capitalism, profit, you know, does not equal, viability. It just means somebody's got stuff to run away with. Yeah. I think having working class backgrounds and those kind of roots, I write about this a lot, and I've talked about this a lot in my own progression into PhD in rhetoric. One of the things that drew me to rhetoric is that rhetoric's not just philosophical. It's not just academic. It's applied, and it's applied in very specific ways. And as we're seeing right now, like with, you know, Zelensky and the Ukraine, you know, it has very active uses in things as important with stakes as high as war. And right. I think when you get that background in the working class, you realize, oh, if I've got a backdrop here, if I know what life feels like over here without the ability to affect my environment, right. And, you know, academics and rhetoric give you that. And that's one of the reasons I've always been drawn to it, because it is a very applied while still being incredibly, you know, esoteric field.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of the best. It's like Miley Cyrus, you know, it's the best of both worlds. You get the action activist end of it, but it's also, it can be a life of the mind too. And that's satisfying.
That's never been put together before, by the way, that rhetoric is the Miley Cyrus of academics.
Yeah, I think that's something to aspire to.
Pretty strong.
If you want to be Miley Cyrus of academics, that's a good goal.
Yeah, and their worst goals. I think you probably pulled some people in with that metaphor. There are probably some people out there like, well, I never really thought about it before, but maybe I should be a rhetorician.
Right. You get the best of both worlds.
If Miley Cyrus can do it.
Right.
Funny.
No, but back to Zelensky. You know, I actually used him in class to get students thinking about the need for rhetoric and why we use this. I mean, usually students will gravitate to rhetoric by saying something like, well, here in Oklahoma, they'll say sugarcoat. Okay, well, I don't want to sugarcoat things. I want to tell you directly what I think. And so at least they know that there's a difference in that degree and that you can sugarcoat and you might choose not to. But there's more to rhetoric than just the idea of making a hard to swallow pill go down easier. Like it can inspire people too. And we were looking at Zelensky giving his selfie speech, is what we've been calling it, academics anyway. I mean, he's talking right into the phone. He's got the Capitol behind him, and he's saying all these really inspiring things. It matters that he's holding a phone. matters that he's casual and confident. All the things, we don't have to get into the words he's using. The presentation of it mattered. And that my students really got into that. We broke it down narratively, talking about setting, plot, things like that. And they just had a ball looking at that. And I think a lot of them left a little wiser to sending a message than maybe they were before they came into class. So that's a triumph, a little personal triumph for me.
Well, you know, and I think that points up one of the problems that I had that in some ways drove me out of teaching. But was the mismatch between the history, the literary tradition, history of the institution of higher education, and what students do now, which is looking through phones, looking through digital, and they don't read in the same way. They don't have the same relationship to messages, and the institution has not made that adjustment.
The institution really doesn't want to. I mean, you might get lucky in a certain place at a certain time with a certain environment. I'm lucky here at Oklahoma State because some of the head people of the English department are rhetoricians who study the digital landscape. So we can exploit that if we wanted to open it up more. But a lot of the old heads at other universities and other places. And if I go to my head and I say something like, well, this would be out of style at this point, but I want my students to learn how to make a good list essay where 10 reasons why blank, you know, that's kind of clickbaity kind of sure. title. Josh would probably be hip to that. It's a little old now, so students aren't actually reading those. But back when I first started teaching at the university or at Oklahoma State, they were everywhere. And my favorite website was cracked.com, and they right. kind of specialized in that. And it was so funny and so informative and so good that I was teaching my students how to do that kind of work. You know, they were getting hooked on crack. Hooked on crack. Well,
and
make sure that dude gets in there.
You got it. You got that pun in there. It was a good travel around the edges. And then you dove right into the pun center. You know, I've blended entertainment and higher order academics and rhetoric for many a year. And I ran into this a lot because my master's degree was at University of Texas, which is very old school. They've adjusted some since I was there, but when I was there, they were just hardcore. A lot of them were even quantitative rhetoricians and, yeah. you know, studied presidential speeches and things like that. And so the idea of entertainment or cultural studies, critical studies coming in as another world to blend with rhetoric offended them. Like, no, we have our own right. tradition. Keep that stuff out of my peanut butter.
Right, right.
But I made the point, like, you cannot study rhetoric anymore in this modern world without also simultaneously studying entertainment. Yeah. Because everybody's so drenched and saturated in entertainment growing up in this culture that if you can't match that, you're going to be a failed rhetorician, period.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a really sobering thought. I mean, the ideas of mass culture and pop culture in academia, that's still pretty radical at this point. I mean,
it's crazy. It's so that, funny. It dominates everything in the world out there.
Right, right. And then so, why? I mean, it doesn't so much happen with me in rhetoric, but I can remember, you know, I actually kind of just ended up in rhetoric because I didn't really know what kind of English major I wanted to be. I started out with creative writing, and then that didn't quite work for me. And then I thought, well, maybe I just want to do literature. And I thought I want to be a literature professor. I actually started here at Oklahoma State with a study of Thomas Pynchon. I thought, okay, I just do this. But then at some point it started to dawn on me that I'm just going to be handing this difficult to read book to a bunch of students who don't want to read it. And I might get one or two to appreciate it each year. And I was like, I don't know. Psychologically, I'm ready to deal with that for the next, you know, until I retire. So I kind of got disillusioned with that. And I thought I was going to go into film and studying film and digital screen. It's called screen studies at the time. I'm not sure what they call it anymore. But I thought new media and film. Okay, that's pretty good. And then I just ended up, I needed another thing to do. So I looked at rhetoric, and that ended up being the thing that I liked the best. Because I was like, oh, you can do anything you want here. It's not so much about labeling something and putting it on the shelf and leaving it on the shelf and then getting angry if somebody thinks it needs to be taken off the shelf or if it's not in the right place in the bookstore or whatever, or library or whatever you want to conceive of it. So is Thomas Pynchon a postmodernist? Well, maybe he's actually a post-postmodernist, or maybe he's just a modernist with a good sense of humor. I don't know why I need to get into that kind of argument.
Right. Well, in some ways, rhetoric is, you know, you're the Dian Fossey of language. Like you have to get in there to real things that are really happening. And it's right. often pushed towards up to date. You know, you're not studying old text as much. There used to be more of that in speech comm with studying speeches and the great speeches and things like that. But I think even that has moved to the back of the line for what, like you said, students can't really access those older texts and those older situations when they're swimming in digital media.
Right. And so what you need to do is look at things like, how does the digital media work? What is digital rhetoric? And then how do we get students embracing some of the things that we know going all the way back 5,000 years or so from rhetoric that still carry forward and still matter in a digital world, but they matter differently in a different way. And so we got to get students caring about it in a different way. I think if you're a good teacher, that should always be the place where you're at. But there tends to be a kind of prescriptiveness that's just sort of off-putting. Like, I'm going to teach you good rhetoric, and this is good rhetoric. And that can happen in rhetoric. It can happen in any study. If we lose that, and it's not entirely terrible, but if we lose the ability to balance that at least with something more descriptive, then I don't understand what we're even doing. Like, we're trying to get people who aren't listening to this thing that we say is great and can't appreciate that it's great. After a while, you got to realize it's not you. It's not the thing. It's maybe the thing's just not great anymore.
Well, and that, I think, is a good point. This idea, are we there to teach appreciation and criticism, okay, the ability to critically see all that's going on? Or are we there to arm people to be active rhetoricians? And yeah, I tend to fall on the other side. Like, I love to take things immediately into use. Even when I was taught the very first class I ever taught as a grad student at Texas, I gave them, I think the assignment was it Jimmy Swaggart, I think, had just gotten knocked off his perch because of being caught with prostitutes in a motel room, something like that.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, so just as an exercise, pick some public figure that you don't like for whatever reason, their politics, and discredit them. Like, that's going to be an assignment. Like, we're all going to do a discreditation.
Wow. Okay.
Go through their bio, do a little research, find something that can be blown up, you know, some scandalous whatever thing, and we'll build that as a rhetorical tactic, a rhetorical project.
Yeah. Wow. Ooh. There's some targets I would love to work on.
Right?
what an exciting piece. I do wonder, though, like, a student turns in an assignment on somebody I like, I would be a little bit disheartened. I don't want to read this.
Yeah, but, you know, when you look at politics right now, it's really, that's the major game.
Sure, that's a good
bet. Discreditation. Like, if you,
right,
that's the entire policy, public policy for discourse for the right. It's find anything and, right, you know, blow it up. We're watching, you know, the Supreme Court confirmation right now, and they literally went back and found, like, hey, you were a little soft on pedophiles.
Right.
What?
You know, I remember thinking yesterday that they messed up doing that because they're trying to imitate Trump. They're not actually doing what Trump would have done. You know, they're still in the kind of the Reagan model of discreditation, where it's like, we find something and exaggerate it. And we're past that, man. We don't need a reality to talk to.
Right.
I mean, who cares that maybe she was soft on pedophilia as a judge some time ago somewhere? And now we get into that argument. I mean, Trump would have done something like, okay, whatever, she's going to be a judge, but her husband, yikes. And that's it. That's all we'd have to say. And then everybody would be frightened of her husband for no reason. I mean, it's libel, really, because he just kind of gets people.
Yeah, it's a politics of slander. Yeah, for sure.
But I mean, that I feel like that's why it doesn't seem to be quite catching on, or at least maybe to me. I'm maybe a little out of the loop a little bit. But it doesn't seem like the attacks that the Republicans are trying to get to land on the judicial candidate are really going to, it doesn't look like they're going to actually stick. It just does. It seems weak or inept or.
Well, and it may be bad discreditation rhetoric, like you're saying. When you go back to Zelensky, Madison Cawthorn, you know, coming out and calling him a thug and saying it's a evil government and trying to stain that and watching everybody go, what?
Right.
Like you can't, like right now, you can't do that rhetoric on that guy.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing about, and I don't think Trump would have made that mistake. You know, I think Trump would have laid into this a certain way. He would have, he has a good way of knowing which way the wind's blowing and how to make that work for him. And he doesn't care if the wind changes tomorrow. He'll change his rhetoric too. It does, there's not a principle there.
But well, and that's reality show rhetoric. Like you attack whatever's there and you overclaim whatever you've got. It doesn't make, but those two side-by-side techniques, that is Trump. It's just slander and overclaim.
Right, right.
You know, yeah. And if anybody, you know, falls out of lockstep with him at all, he just goes at him with full armaments, like he just did to Mo Brooks, who finally said, like, let's move on from this lies about the 2016 election or 2020 election. And you know, Trump just for the last 2 days have just lambasted this guy.
Yeah, it's funny to me. I'm not really sure how that's going to work, but you know, it like I keep getting locked in these kind of logical battles with Trump, and that's where he wants you to be. Because he's not making that battle. And you're going to be anchored into this argument that you think you're going to have. And then he's going to come pull the rug out from under you.
Right. Well, and the counter technique of that is not to engage in the logic. Like you can't let them set the terms. You can't, you know, counter what they've said. Because as soon as you do, then, you know, you've followed their agenda. Like you literally just need, like, if they're saying pedophilia to you, you literally, instead of ever saying the response to that, you literally just say, well, I've got this massive, you know, litigation history. I've won all these cases against murderers. I've won all this. And you just never even engage their word.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But that takes a real discipline because they just hector you and badger you until you respond to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you can see that play out in real time with Trump versus Obama over the birth certificate. I mean, he was fine ignoring Trump. And the second it became a prop on television, he thought he was squashing him. Look, here it is. That rushed him. You blew wind into his sails and you could have just let him flop around.
Well, and if Biden does have a superpower politically, he's incredibly disciplined. He would not engage with things. I remember even the Hunter Biden stuff, which, man, they hit that gong so many times. And Biden literally just said, we shouldn't be talking about our kids. And he got a little flare up one time during the debates, and then that was it. And he would not go back there. And that takes real rhetorical discipline.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I actually think Biden's a pretty great rhetorician. I think he's close to being the kind of rhetorician that we need to combat people like Trump, but he's a little old-fashioned, and he seems to be picking battles that are harming him with his own base. And it's like,
well, at least the progressives in his base.
Right, right. That's true. I keep thinking that's a bigger part because I come from that. So I'm going to be thinking there's more of them. You know?
I would have loved to have seen Bill Clinton up against these guys, you know, because Clinton had the same discipline, but he was also charming and quick on his feet and was very improvisational, you know, in the moment. He would have been a really interesting opponent to somebody like Trump.
Yeah, that would have been pretty cool. And it's harder to win tough guy points against Bill Clinton for some reason, too. He doesn't really come off as like a tough guy, but it just doesn't seem like that kind of rhetoric phases him.
Well, so, you're one of your areas of interest of disinformation and going into the web, like you probably have to have quite a bit of rhetorical discipline to be able to talk to the deep right, you know, in conversations.
Oh yeah. At this point I've grown quite a thick skin to most forms of hate rhetoric.
We'll talk about that some, because I think it's a fascinating rhetorical activity that a lot of people who are academic rhetoricians would benefit from. Like I tell people, I learned to do stand-up for real in Florida biker bars, where right. You have to go in and you don't have all the privileges of middle-class performance where everybody is quiet and they give you the floor and all that. You have to earn it. You have to break them, and you have to have techniques for that. And so I think that you get a lot of that too with direct interaction with enemies.
Right. Yeah. And you have to be real clear on how you're defining what would lay outside that border is, what is an enemy, you know? I think you're right. I tend to go out and battle people that a lot of people won't defend anyway, you know? I'll go and argue with people in hate groups. I'll go and argue with people in conspiracy theory groups and stuff like that. I don't recommend trying to argue with flat earthers because they'll just kick you out. They don't like to hear the opposition. If they catch even a whiff of it, you're gone. But a lot of the hate groups and extreme dark web kind of those sort of nefarious players on the right, they'll stick around. They will double down and try to argue with you. And it does help you grow a really thick skin. It helps you see ahead of time the kind of heckling an idea might get. I think you're right. I think if more rhetoricians took a little bit of their time and did that, I mean, I probably overdo it. It was started as a hobby, and then it ended up kind of helping me figure out what I wanted to do in digital rhetorics. But it's not exactly the healthiest thing to do either. It can make it a little bit depressing. Sure. Because, you know, you'll be hanging out on a web forum with hate groups, and they'll say something, and you'll think, well, that's kind of weird. And 2 or 3 days later, you'll hear like your neighbor, who you know is not in a hate group, say the exact same talking point. And you're like, now how did that happen? There's a connection here on the right that there's a flow channel somewhere.
Yeah.
Between these obvious hate groups and the types of rhetoric that we see happening in everyday speech. And it's a little depressing. Like I'll say this to people, and they're always kind of shocked by it. But the first time I ever heard anybody say anything bad about CRT and why it should be banned, it was on a hate group forum. It was for, I think they call themselves V-Dare now or something. Identity Europa or whatever they were. They've changed their names like 3 times. And I forgot what they call themselves now. But that was the first time I saw it. I was arguing with some people on that about just, you know, things I usually argue about. Like, come on, you can't really justify that white people, there's a white ethnicity that runs from Scotland to England, to Italy, to the Caucasus region, to Greece. That's all one ethnicity. You can't argue that. And they would get really kind of bent out of shape. Or I would just ask them a simple question like, are Greeks white? And the forum would get into this huge fight with each other. They would just dig into each other.
Right.
So I was just, you know, doing my thing. Regular day for me, a regular Sunday. See if I can make these people angry.
Doing the Lord's work on Sunday.
And I hear this guy say CRT. And I was just like, I haven't heard that since grad school. CRT. I remember talking about it a little bit, but I mean, it was kind of considered sort of old by the time we were covering it. So why are we talking about critical race theory now? I mean, we did like that much work on it in a class that was devoted to Derrida. and Derrida Dawes out of fashion. So it's like,
well, it's a perfect, it's perfect though. CRT, like critical, is a demon word because they don't know what that means, but it means alternative thinking, race, and then theory, which is always suspect.
Not fact. We're talking about theory.
Yeah. And it's got all that stuff that like Marxism and all that doesn't care. They, you know, try to throw Marxism and socialists and communists around, but that has been used, that's been trampled on. CRT was brand new. And I don't know if you've seen the stuff like on where the people on YouTube go out and interview Trumpers, you know, at the rallies, and they ask them about, so what's your big issue now? Like CRT, well, what is it? Well, I don't know, but I don't like it.
Right.
But it's perfect in that world of, again, sort of the Baudrillard simulation of this symbol has no meaning for them, but it has emotional impact. And that's what you want.
I like that you went with demon terms and God terms too. I mean, if we go back to Weaver and the way that he was talking about those words, that's really important now. And studying the way that it works in propaganda is important work. And it's not going to hurt rhetoric to look at that. Now, in fact, it's going to help us. And I feel like when rhetoric first started to come kind of out of the shadows and into academia again, because it was the center of academia, I think people were worried that it was going to get the reputation of being propaganda. So there's not a lot of, like, if you go back to the 80s and 90s, there's not a lot of people studying propaganda or those kinds of things. And so rhetoric was supposed to be legitimized. No, when we talk about rhetoric, we're talking about it making a good argument, a good deliberative argument.
They shorn it down to its safe areas, like rationality. I'm like, that's one area of rhetoric. That's not even close to being, to me, the dominant area of rhetoric. Debate and argument, great, but that's not how people get persuaded these days. So come on, let's.
Right, and it was just such a move to get it recognized on academic terms at that time. And that limited what we can say about rhetoric or what we need to have as a study of rhetoric. And I feel like now, though, we're kind of open to it. In the post-Trump world, with a lot of writers, a lot of rhetoric, a lot of rhetoricians working on that and trying to figure out what happened, what we can do, we're starting to turn a corner now where we can go, okay, forgive another pop culture reference, but we can teach Defense Against the Dark Arts now.
And well, when the authoritarian rhetoric came home to roost in America, like it's always been here, but when it grew up into national politics and a national politician grabbed it and used it to get elected president, suddenly you're like, hey, maybe, you know, this isn't just the Nazis. I think you're right. As a rhetorician, if you study propaganda or the Nazis or politics or entertainment, you become suspect. And also advertising. Right? I mean, we went against the heart of American capitalism by deconstructing advertising. You know, that whole move in the 80s of, hey, subliminal advertising and all this crazy stuff is happening over there. You guys probably want to know some of this. And business was like, no, they don't. They don't want to know that.
No, quit. You're giving away our secrets. And then there was the ad busting movement, which was just so much fun. And my students still love that. I'll have them do a little ad busting. If we're ever bored and we need another assignment or something, I'm just going to bring out ad busting and go, okay, here we go, guys. And they've never seen it. It's new to them. And they're just like, I never thought about just making fun of advertisement in general. And it's neat how they do it too. Like you can play into, or you can kind of deconstruct. And so you can kind of roll with the punch in a way. So you can kind of take the advertisement that they're already campaigning on and extend it to its ludicrous end. And that's fun to do. Or you can just kind of blow it up from the center too. And students really like engaging in that. It's everywhere around them. It's not like they're mindless automatons either that are just kind of taking in advertising and not critically thinking about it. They are critically aware of it. They just don't know there's an outlet for it. And they don't know what to do with those kinds of thoughts and feelings, because there's nowhere to put that. So that's another place where a good rhetorician, teacher, speech, or English writing, doesn't matter which, but that's a place where you can get them working in mediums that they understand and mediums that they want to work in. And, you know, forget this kind of, like, well, why am I teaching you to write even an academic paper? I mean, even if you go on and get a degree in a rigorously academic field, you're probably not going to write an academic paper ever, unless right. you go all the way and get to be the PhD. So why am I putting so much pressure on you figuring out APA format, MLA format, a literature review? Some of these moves that we find as common for academics, when really what you ought to be learning how to write is a better blog.
Sure.
Or a better YouTube video. I mean,
well,
you're still writing.
And I think you're pointing up exactly what we were talking about earlier, that rhetoric has to be based on use. It can't be based on just rote tradition.
Right.
And I think that's often what happens in higher academics in the institution, is that, well, we've always taught the essay, we've always taught the persuasive speech, ergo, right. we'll just keep doing that. And I'm like, no. If you want to grab these people, like, you go into their entertainment and go, well, let's take, you know, Ren and Stimpy apart. Let's take right. the Animaniacs or whatever you want to take, and take it apart and see right. how it's put together. And then, like, oh my God, it's put together. It's
yeah,
actually designed.
Right.
You know, and like, yeah, somebody, writers and producers actually know how to put these together. They're rhetoricians. And now yep. just drag that over to politics and look at that. They're doing it there too. Drag it over to right. advertising. And suddenly they've started to get that critical apparatus, but it grows from their lived experience, as opposed to dragging them into doing a public speech, which they never do.
Yeah, I mean, the closest you would get is a blog post or a video, you know, where you can say, this is what is bugging me, and I want more people to know why it's bugging me. And that's about as close as we can get to that kind of outlet. You know, a lot of students aren't participating in that way either. So, I mean, the idea that we can, it's almost like, well, we got the essay, so we can turn it into a YouTube video, right? And it's like, well, you're kind of going backwards.
Right.
You want to go from the YouTube video outwards. Like, what is it? What are they watching on YouTube? What are they doing when they get on YouTube? And there might be some things that you know, are overtly political. But I mean, if we're looking at their online activity, it's memes. That's what they're doing. And you can study that. And you can sure. see the pattern for that. You can see the design elements for that. You can deconstruct that. You can come up with ways to make the meme do what it's doing now in a different form. Hell, you maybe make up a meme that catches on. That'd be cool.
Yeah, right. I mean, something that actually might go out into your lived network and have an effect, as opposed to right. handing this paper into your professor and it never seeing the light of day ever again anywhere at any moment in anybody's experience, which right. always bugged me again, academics. I'm like, come on. Right. 99.9% of all this effort never does anything, and that is right. not right.
Yeah, I remember being in getting my PhD toward the end of the experience, and all of my, you know, academic advisors and professors and stuff are all on Twitter, and I'm just hanging out on Twitter watching them talk to each other and stuff, and Ron Brooks is like, he was such a great help for me writing my dissertation. He wasn't like my first reader or anything. He was kind of like a third guy that read it, but he gave me such great advice when I needed it. He's kind of like the sage that had been through the process before. And he was just sort of like giving me wisdom to make it through. And he just made a meme, and I forgot what the meme was for, but it went viral on Twitter. And he was just like, okay, I'm turning off notifications for this because it's got ever how many thousand, whatever. And I acknowledge fully that more people will have seen that meme than will have ever seen any of my academic writing. And I was just like, oh, okay, you're right. That was the one thing he said the whole time that we were putting this dissertation together that made me go, oh, I need to get it done now. Okay, how do I get back to that, you know, getting the gumption to finish this same thing?
Right. Well, and you do.
More people are going to read it.
I've always moved, even when I was in academics, I moved back and forth between entertainment and academics. I remember I was a staff writer at the Late Late Show, and a lot of times on talk shows, they don't have time or budget to go out and get actors, so they throw writers into the sketches. And so I was thrown into sketches a few times. I'm a terrible actor, but to the point where I am in the Actors Guild, I'm in SAG-AFTRA, like a thing that most actors can't even get into. And yeah. I was started to be recognized on the streets. People would be like, cool. Hey, were you on for like the different sketches I did? And I realized I've reached millions of people through this thing. And the message I had, one of the sketches we did was Bill O'Reilly was accused of sexual harassment by his assistant. And right, she had recorded it and had transcripts. And so
that was a falafel tape, wasn't it? Where he says falafel.
It was all sorts of crazy stuff.
I can't remember. It was like something being in a shower, and instead of grabbing like a sponge, he says falafel. And you're like, why do you have a falafel in the shower, dude?
It was very funny. And so they put me in a wife beater and a pen light in front of the audience, and I read the transcript like it was a romance novel.
Oh, how great.
And
that's smart.
I was terrible, but the bit was great. So it still worked, but yeah, people started recognizing me and I'm like, okay, I've studied rhetoric for 20 years at this point. I've done thousands of stand-up performances. I will never, ever, ever reach this many people. And that's the only thing I got to say was Bill Riley's.
That's a good guy to take down though. I mean, of course, now we have Tucker Carlson, it's probably worse, but man, he was a big figure when it was time, though.
It's amazing how fast they come down, like once, and they are replaceable. You know, I think everyone that comes up behind them is worse because they got to outperform and out ugly the person before them.
That's a good point.
But I, you know, when you talk about going into these right-wing groups, like I grew up in the South, I grew up in Kentucky, which is a border Midwestern Southern state.
Right.
And most of my very working class. So I grew up around all that. My grandparents were racist. My parents weren't, basically because they never had to be, they never really had any interaction with anybody that wasn't white. And they're both good people. So, but I remember, you know, growing up around racism, like strong racism, yeah. I'm not as triggered by it or as scared of it, I think, as a lot of the left is. Because like any rhetoric, there's dimensionality to it and there's inroads into it to how to break it. But if you just instantly demonize and trigger, you stop becoming a rhetorician and you just become, you know, an attack dog on these things that have been said. And that doesn't do anything.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't sway public opinion. I mean, it would be nice if it did. I mean, just to be honest, it probably would hurt Trump if there was a video or a tape of him actually saying the N-word out loud.
Right.
I mean, that would still be something that would carry something, but it would have to be something that drastic and that obvious. And racism just. It really never functioned that way. It's always been this kind of invisible power structure, even when it's at its most nasty. It was weird to question that there were Black people as slaves. Like, why would you even question that? There were a few people that were, but they were like fringe people and they were easily ignored. And so it's the invisible power structure that really matters. And I think you're right that if you do have a sort of thick skin for this, you recognize that it's important, you don't like it, but you've seen it. It does.
Well, and you know, and you know that there's still a human being behind it, and you know they're changeable. Like, there are ways of changing the right, no matter how heinous they are at the moment, because they've probably arrived there without much thought. They've been in an indoctrinated system. They're not that hard to change if you can get in and do that kind of one-on-one over time, you know, kind of change. And it doesn't matter the topic. I used to say, I used to have a joke about when I moved to Los Angeles from Florida, I was living at the time. I'm like, I don't see how people are racist in Los Angeles, because you would be exhausted. You know, every culture on earth is here and you don't even know what people are. You're like, you're from where? Should I hate you? Are you, you know, the KKK would just be four people laying on the ground in sheets out here going, I can't do it anymore. I'm just tired. Right.
Well, I mean, you know, studies bear this out too. I mean, it's not just us kind of speculating that most racists don't have any access to anybody other than themselves. And that's why they can keep reinforcing the racist views that they have. And it's kind of funny though, because there are people that can change and that are changeable, but the influencers in those circles, there's no hope of changing them. Like they've got a bank account that is set on them. Richard Spencer is happy being a racist, and he's going to stay a racist until he dies.
I don't know, man. Like, you know, you may have to go through a different avenue, but I've seen this stuff. But you've seen this stuff even with people like trans or gay or lesbian, that they will have a kid that, you know, is gay or trans. And at first it all blows up. But over time, there's no way to continually just dehumanize your own child.
Right.
And you see and it that, over time. It may take a while, but that starts to, you know, because the faulty logic of racism or sexism or genderism or any of that stuff doesn't hold up against real experience.
No, that's the thing. And I mean, the studies do show that just having contact with people different from you is really what's causing all this liberalness in the university. And it's just sort of like, no, we just have friends now. Like, I left my small town where it was completely white, and now I've got friends that are Muslim because they were here.
Right.
They were down the hall from me, and we both like PlayStation 4. So, hey, here we are. PlayStation 5 now. So, I mean, that's what's really causing these breakdowns, these barriers. And then they come home and mom and dad are watching Fox News or whatever, and they see a threat on their traditions.
Sure.
And so they get indignant about it.
As they should. I mean, it is a threat on their traditions.
Right. And if we go one-on-one, and you're careful and you're, I guess it sounds funny to say this kind of word, but if you're loving about it, that you can create change, and it does take a long time. And it has to do with, like you say, creating those experiences, creating those networks, and getting people outside that little bubble or enclave that they're in. And you can do that, but there's other things that happen, particularly online with like the big influencers. You know, if I'm talking to Richard Spencer one-on-one, I'm going to have to bring my A game. I'm going to have to bring somebody else's A game. It's not even going to just be my A game, man. I'm going to have to go find Cicero and bring his A game or something. You know, it's not going to just, I wouldn't be able to do that on somebody with that level. But with like, you know, an uncle or an aunt or a cousin or somebody, or a friend or a neighbor, that I can create those sort of inroads, and I can get on that level and work the long game. But if you're in a situation where you've got a chance to ridicule Richard Spencer publicly and it's gonna work, you should take that chance. Take
maybe
that opportunity.
I don't know. There's so many dimensions to this, and this is one of the reasons why I tend to land in war metaphors for rhetoric, because I see it as battles. I don't see it as civility and, you know, a sort of basically, you know, friendly democracy where we're just working it through ideas, because I just never have experienced that. I look at it as there are two herds here, and my job isn't to just tell my herd things that make them laugh and feel better. My job is to grab red cows and drag them over, you know, slowly into purple and then over into blue, because that's the world I want. I have clearly, it's not liberal, it's nice. I just want nice people who like being intellectual and rational. That I think it's a better world.
Right.
They're not judgmental and, you know, all these different things that you can sort of throw at the right. But how do you grab red cows is the real question. And I think you're right. Like if you see like a dominant red cow, like an influencer, you're like, well, that's going to take some specialty rhetoric to get that, to get that person. But you can still design it. You can do the work.
That's probably true.
If it was important to you as a rhetorician, you're like, oh yeah, I've got all these tactics and tools that have to adapt them down to this person in this situation. And you start getting effectiveness, because that's the big offer of rhetoric, because we've got way more tools and tactics and theories.
Well, I think one of the things with ridicule is it's not so much that I need to ridicule Richard Spencer in a way that makes, you know, the nearest liberal laugh. Like, that's going to be too simple. I mean, you have to make Richard Spencer look like an ass in front of those other red cows. Like, you got to hit him with something that's going to make them laugh at him and then distance themselves from him. And now all of those cows that were previously influenced are gettable. And that's one of the powers of ridicule that I think can tend to be overlooked when we look at rhetoric and wanting things like civility, which tends to be the way we go with this. And we tend to think of it as one-on-one. Or if not one-on-one, we tend to think of it like our students in our classroom. Now, I wouldn't ridicule a student. That would be dumb. First, it wouldn't work. It just wouldn't work. I would look like a jerk. And then anything I stand for would also look bad. And we just kind of, that's terrible. But then I would lose my job, obviously. And rightfully.
Which is interesting, because when I work in stand-up, I get paid to ridicule people. Like that is the heroic moment.
Setting.
Audiences like nothing better than when a villain has emerged in the audience and you eviscerate them.
Right.
Now, they don't like you going after innocents, but if somebody's drunk or they say something mean or they're talking, man, do audiences like it when you tear that person apart in front of them.
Yeah, I mean, well, because you're the person who's supposed to be the wittiest in the room. You know, whenever they see that wit turned on a villain, they've got to cheer for it. I mean, it's just perfect. But as witty as you can be standing at a podium, usually in a lecture hall or in a little classroom, if somebody says something mean in your classroom and you zing them good, you're not going to look like, you're just not going to look like the insult comic that has won the room. You're going to look like somebody who said something kind of odd at the wrong time.
All the professors, like you get all the teacher ethos where you're supposed to be compassionate and caring, parent substitute and all these things, which make the environment pretty boring. Which goes back to the idea, you know, that education has neutered itself to the point where, you know, now the politicians are coming in and going, oh, there's some things you haven't neutered and I can use that for political advantage.
Right.
So how dare you teach my children anything other than white Christianity? Get back.
Right. I mean, this is kind of funny, because if we go back to Richard Spencer, if we try to go and get him with the tools that we normally have as academics, he just flaps them away. I mean, I've seen him with interviews, and he'll say, okay, you think that the white people are the dominant race in America and in the world. And he's just like, well, yeah, I mean, it's just scientifically proven that way. You know, Richard Spencer's like steeped in this stuff. Everything he reads and interacts with reinforces this stuff. And so this person said, well, he said what I would have said at the time. Then if we go back to the historical record and we look at medical equipment and how that's been created and changed over time, we can see that white Europeans at one point were drilling holes in the heads of people with fever to let the ghost out, let the bad demon out. At the same time, the exact same time, in America, the Cherokee were using pharmaceuticals, and they had invented the hypodermic needle. And it was something like that was said to Richard Spencer. And he was just like, I don't believe that. That's stupid. You show me. And of course, the guy didn't have anything that would Richard Spencer would take seriously. So he just kept just as easy as it was to just go, nah. Yeah. And you're expecting an intellectual exchange. And Spencer's just like, nah. And that's all he had to do. It was done. And his audience was fine with it. The audience that had already didn't like Spencer going in had more reason to not like him. So that was an abject failure, going that intellectual route.
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons, like, I launched this podcast by saying, you know, Rhetorical Guardians of the Galaxy, because there are no judges. There's nobody organizing the public discourse. Richard Spencer in that situation has the power to do communication rules.
That's a good
environment. So he gets to simply say, I'm out. I'm not answering that. Well, if you give the nefarious the power to run the communication, you're going to get some really bad communication.
Right. Right.
There's nothing there controlling him or saying, no, we don't get to do that. We don't get to leave the interview, you know,
right.
We don't get to stand up and go, I'm not listening to this. You know, how dare you discredit my slandering of others? You know,
right.
Dare you ask me about my criminal behavior?
How dare you object to my completely baseless accusation?
And if you don't have somebody running the rhetoric, then that's going to happen all the time. They just grab all the controlling communication power.
Right.
And you can't win in that situation because they're literally not playing with the normal rules of communication. You can go, okay, if you're going to do that, then we have to, again, as rhetoricians, step back and go, okay, hey, when he does that, when he does the nah, here's the way we react. If you haven't planned that environment, designed that environment to deal with a nefarious communicator, an unethical communicator, you're in trouble.
Right.
Like I had to design my environment how to deal with Florida bikers.
You know? Right.
Like when you walk up, they don't want to just be quiet. They're going to yell at you. So pick the biggest guy in the room and accuse him of hitting on you. Like, are you hitting on me? Are you attracted to me? Is that why you're yelling at me? And his buddies will lose their minds laughing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you win.
No. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I remember me and some buddies went and watched Jake the Snake Roberts wrestle against the Honky Tonk Man at the end of their careers in early 2000s at this little rinky-dink place in, I think it was in Muskogee, I can't even remember, but they were playing there because, you know, get a few bucks. And these guys were incredible insult comics. Both of them were just incredible. I remember just leaving that and going, I remembered why my dad liked the Honky Tonk Man so much. And I was like, why could you like him, Dad? He's the bad guy. Why are you liking him? But after seeing him actually perform and being older and understanding that this is part of the show, he's not like a bad guy. He's playing a bad guy character. I could see just how beautiful his rhetorical moves were. And I remember I got a picture with Jake the Snake Roberts, and I asked him if I could DDT him or if he could DDT me, and he said, nah, I can't do that because, you know, I might get sued. And I said, oh, okay, that's cool. I understand. But it's just like private conversation nobody heard. And so when I asked if I could DDT to him, I gave the signal for it, and the crowd saw it. And Jake was like, no, I can't do that because they only let me wrestle men. And my friends loved it.
Oh, yeah.
They still taunt me about that. And so I get that. That's really the move there with these influencers, is you've got to figure out how to get their crowd turned on them. It's not about getting your crowd to look better. It's about, and that's hard work. And that takes listening to conservatives and taking them seriously. Because you don't have an inroad.
It takes really good writers. So I've got a buddy who wrote, he was the executive producer for 3 years for WWE. And like, that's what he had, huge staffs of people writing insults and one-liners and storylines and things like that, because that's what you need. And I made that argument many times about Hillary Clinton not having a really good couple of insult comics on staff was just a major rhetorical flaw in her strategy with Trump, because Trump is just an insult guy. So you have to have counters. Like, if you can trump somebody's insult, oh man, that is the ultimate win. Like, they look like they've got you, and you hit them back with something worse, and it's done.
Right.
In comedy writer rooms, they often call that a grenade thrower.
Right, like, right.
It's done. Nobody's going to beat that.
Yeah, back when I used to do, I thought I was going to be a literature major, right? So I used to do some Black studies to get into that world of Black literature and stuff. And playing the dozens is exactly that. It's about taking that insult, turning it like a judo flip on the person who said it to you, coming out on top, and then you're done. It's over at that point. It doesn't matter what that next insult's going to be from the person who just got hammered in that exchange. It could be brilliant. The crowd's lost. They're gone. It's done.
Yeah, once you blow it up, that's roast battles and all that stuff. I used to do intellectual yo mama jokes where I was blending academics. One of them was, your mama's so dumb that she only gets single entendres.
Okay, that was good.
Yeah, well, you know, it's got its 3%ers.
It's just funny how that was sitting there for anybody to say, and then you come along and say it. That's one of the greatest things about this being witty, I think, is just sort of like, why didn't somebody else come up with that earlier? How was that there so long? It's just amazing that.
Well, one thing you find in comedy writing, this is why I've always loved the interaction of rhetoric and comedy, especially comedy writing, is that so much of it is mechanistic technique. It's a tactic, and you learn these things. Like, if you just, and I do, my brain just does this for fun now. If you just hear words and do a comedy treatment on them where you flip it or you half it or anything like that, it creates these interesting outcomes that you can then write a setup for. I remember thinking double entendre and then going single entendre is funny. And then I backtracked it into that joke structure.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. That's really cool.
One of the other ones you can do is take the first letter of things that you find interesting and just oscillate all the way through the alphabet with a new first letter until you get to something interesting. So one of the ones I did it with was Bohemians. Like, in Austin, there's so many Bohemians, but really, and I went down C, Crohemians, Hohemians, Dohemians. I got to Fohemians.
Okay.
Like, that's Austin.
That's good.
They are Fohemians.
Yeah.
But it was totally, I was just playing with the word and then I add a setup.
Right. And a great observation.
But I didn't really make it. It just made itself. I just, the technique, kind of, and then I recognized, that's really good for that particular population.
Yeah, I'm amazed that this can be taught too. Is, you know, I remember I was far too shy and far too stage fright. To ever get on stage and try to be funny. My world was, I can write a story that has comedic elements and somebody else can say the funny thing and that'll work. And that's where I was. The idea of just getting up there and just talking at the time, forget it. But I remember buying a book called The Comedian's Bible. And there were recipes for making these kinds of observations and turning things inside out. Creating an act out on your joke and creating the structure for jokes and how to analyze jokes and all this stuff. And it was really pretty useful book for playwriting, because there's not a lot of great books on comedy. There's not a lot of people that talk about the actual techniques you need to go from step A, step B, step C to get to that joke. There's so much of an understanding that it's an inborn natural talent that you just either have or don't. And then if you don't have it, you're just SOL. You're just permanently part of the audience. And it's like, you cannot be anything other than that. And it's not true.
You have to learn the techniques and practice them and slowly let them immerse. And then my brain is so fast because I've been doing it for 35 years now on stages, and I write comedy. I write jokes every day. I can go up and do an hour of stand-up just talking to the audience, and not like, hey, right, Here's a couple of laughs here and there, but like every 7 seconds is a quality punchline kind of stand-up, because my brain is just fast at it, using the techniques. Right. And so, you know, when you start to see rhetoric like that, like, yeah, it's this massive trove of 2,500 years of study of the techniques and tactics and strategies. Just start learning them. And then if you want to go argue with Richard Spencer, look at that. You've got a little weapon cache to pull out and hit him with a bazooka of ridicule or whatever you want to hit him with.
Or whatever your tactic may be. I mean, I guess maybe coming from the punk rock scene, I like ridicule. I appreciate ridicule. I see its power, and I think it's a tool that a lot of academics are reluctant to pick up for whatever reason.
Well, it's like you said, it is a dangerous tool. If you do it wrong, you come off, you know, as immoral and too harsh if you go after the innocent. But that's why you need villains to really hit hard.
Right.
But like, when one of the techniques I use when I talk to the right is what I would call something like Socratic exaggeration, where I just ask the next step up of their belief of what we should do. So I'm like, okay, should we have what we should do with illegal immigrants? Like, we should build a wall. I'm like, well, why don't we just let them in? And would you shoot an illegal immigrant? Like, if they go across an invisible line, you say, if you go across this line, we're going to shoot you. Would you go for that?
Right.
And a lot of them be like, maybe, you know. And I'm like, well, would you do it personally? If there was a bounty on illegal immigrants, would you, like, you could bag 5 a year?
Right. Yeah.
And it always reaches a point where they quickly go, well, no, I wouldn't do that. I'm like, well, it's the same idea. You're just taking it to an extreme that now you've reached a place like the wall is far too much for most people. But we believe in laws to keep illegal immigrants out. You know, there should be a legal process. Nobody is arguing against that.
Right. Well, I mean, if you go into the anarchist circles, you'll find them, but they're so fringe. And even the word anarchist at this point, too, kind of from being from the punk scene, too, that might have been why I got such a thick skin going into the hate world, too. It's just like, man, I'm used to having my political beliefs undermined left and right. You know, I mean, my idea of a candidate for president that is a compromised person was like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. Like, that was me going, I can move to the right and accept those figures. You know?
No,
So I totally get it. You know, reading Noam Chomsky and all that stuff, and Conquest for Bread and Kropotkin and all those people, and just like really digging it and loving the people around me and meeting all the people in anarchist circles and having all that kind of talk and seeing it reinforced. But it's such a small, the second I leave that, if I tell my brother, hey man, let's try no government, boom, right there, 10 arguments why you should.
Yeah.
10 ways of undermining, you know. So it kind of gets you a little bit of a thicker skin, and it makes you think more rationally too. I mean, if you get the right person in the right room, they'll say something like, okay, but what, when you say a state needs to be dissolved, what exactly do you mean by state? And you're in an organization, is that not also some kind of state? And then you start having those conversations, and both sides end up being better off.
Then you're fine. I think, again, that's the promise of really good rhetoric training, is that everybody realizes, oh, we can just talk about all these things and we can all sort of do verbal, you know, battle and interaction and get to a place. We don't have to use emotional hatreds and, you know, all these sort of allegiances that, that emerge. That is the ultimate offer here. This is still a word nerd game, you know.
Right. No, I mean, I think this is the goal. I think, at least for me, for my students, whenever I go into a room and start teaching, I want them to be able to participate as democratic citizens, holding certain truths, you know, to be self-evident. You know, everybody here is equal, even if we don't have the same.
That's not true, though. That's never true.
The conservatives really like to go for that idea. But I mean, the idea here is that your voices count an equal amount. And it's not that I'm saying that we're equal to Kevin Duckworth. I mean, I can't dunk a basketball, but he can't, I don't know. I mean, it's like, I'm not going to try to get into that kind of materialist kind of point, you know. I mean, at that point, it's like, well, yeah, we're not all equal, of course. But I don't get to begrudge somebody a chance to enhance democratic policy just because I think they're somewhere lower on a human hierarchy somewhere. If there's a Black person, he doesn't really get to talk about policy. They're not capable of thinking clearly enough to do this, or women aren't also. They're just not able to do this, you know. Democracy is the promise that we can all share in that argument about where policy is. And if we're nice enough to each other, if we're loving enough to each other, and we care about the world we live in, and that's where things start to go fuzzy, we should be able to advance. We should be able to stop some of the problems that we're having.
I like it. We should all, it's the loveocracy. So
yeah, it's the Eros.
Well, cool, man. This has been super fun again. Just like the last time, hopefully we've got good sound this time.
Man, I really hope so. Anytime you want to talk again, I would love to do it.
Yeah, for sure. Let's circle back around. There's so many cool things to talk about here. Even this last thing about loveocracy. I think it's hilarious.
Oh, that'd be kind of fun. I mean, one of the great things about doing this that you've opened my eye to is this idea of teaching comedy. When so many people think that it's just an inherent, you're good at it or you're not. That's what we used to think about writing. Well, a lot of students think that about writing anyway. But once we started really studying writing, we figured out, oh, well, this is teachable. There's a process to this. There's a pattern to this. That should be something that I want to instill in my students. So I would love to talk about some of these techniques that are learnable and applicable for comedy and help my students even learn how to use these techniques better. Could be part of the Rhetorical Guardians of the Galaxy. These are the
The comedy division. Let's bring the comedians up to do some work here.
I get like 50 people a year or 50 people a semester that are going out into the world armed with these kind of techniques. That's not nothing. So
no, that's a contribution. I think I've never looked down on academics for its contribution. It's sort of, you know, it's myopic internal contributions. Again, moved over into entertainment, and I want the stuff done at the big levels. I want the rhetoric channel on TV and cable, like Netflix, so that people can access this stuff in a way that they're like, oh, this isn't just esoteric academic nerds talking about this. This is me figuring out how to get a raise at work because I know better how to ask for it. Like the thing about it, know how to be a parent using persuasion instead of smacking my kids around and teach them how to be, you know, subjected to physical punishment or not.
And how to avoid you when something bad happens because I know they're going to get smacked. So.
Horrible idea. Well, cool, man. Super fun. We will circle back around. Everybody go find Jonesy at Oak State. And you have a blog or
Yeah, I have a blog. I usually post it on Twitter, but it's Jonesy OK State at WordPress. And I update that as frequently as I can. I'm trying to get a new band started. I've got a band camp with one song on it where I've remixed Jennifer Mercia talking about how propaganda works or how conspiracy theories work. And I just worked it into a kind of ska punk beat. And
I'll send me the link for that. I got to hear that.
Yeah, I'll send you one.
Yeah, hilarious. Well, cool, man. All right. We will circle back around for sure. Fun talking to you. Everybody get out there and persuade. That's the offer. Humanity needs it. And you now have more techniques for doing it. So get out there.